This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. At its weekly meeting, Cincinnati City Council celebrated a new city manager, voted on a difficult public health policy, and made it clear how they felt about a long-awaited report on the ways to improve downtown traffic. To explore what happened in local government this week, we are joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. If you want to join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
And
happy to be here.
Let's just start out with the easy stuff. And that is
there anything easy?
They took the interim off of Patrick Dehaney's title and made him the permanent full-time city manager. And, you know, it may not sound like that important, but being an interim, I can speak from personal experience, it's a difficult position because nobody knows if you're real, if they take you seriously, if how long you're going to be there. So he's been there. He's been interim for 8 months. So, Jay, was it just a foregone conclusion that this was the right person?
I think the longer in time that he went from when he was named in April, it was likely that that was going to be the pick. And it was surprising that I know when this first started back in April after Harry Black resigned, there was at least a few council members who were pushing for there to be a national search for a replacement. And it was interesting, even this week, a couple of them came on board and said, you know, the longer that they were around Patrick Dehaney, the more comfortable they were with him. And even David Mann pointed out, I think, that he said that he has confirmed 6 previous city managers and all of those involved in national search. This one, he actually got to work with the candidate for 8 months in advance, so he felt like he knew this person more than he did anyone that had interviewed through a national search.
Right. Searches have lots of limits to them. You just don't know.
And if you think about a national search at this point, you know, the city manager serves at the pleasure of the mayor with the consent of 5 council members. We have a mayor who cannot run for another term in 2021. So if you had done a national search, by the time you'd done the search and done the interviews and they got relocated, in theory, they probably would have maybe had like 2.5, 2 years on the job, and which is about the shelf life for as a city manager. And this way, if everything works out, you know, Mr. Dehaney will be the city manager for about 3 years.
Right. You know, the longer this went on where he was interim, the less likely a national search was going to be done. I don't think the mayor was very interested in doing that anyway. I think he wanted a local candidate, and he probably wanted somebody from in the administration, you know, itself. And it was interesting because I heard the same thing Jay did early on, where there were council members, you know, particularly P.G. Sittenfeld, and I think Wendell was one of them, and maybe Chris Seelbach, who, you know, they really wanted and Greg Landsman as well. They wanted a national search done because that, frankly, is good practice. We don't know everything here in Cincinnati. It's kind of helpful to have outside.
We don't?
Yeah, we don't. It's surprising to many people, but, it's helpful to have outside perspectives. But I think the longer that they, you know, this was a 9-0 vote. That was a pretty lopsided vote, obviously. It was 8-0, but Amy Murray was absent. Right. She said she would have voted for him had she been there. This was an overwhelming vote of confidence for Mr. Dehaney.
Well, one of the things is that they have asked Harry Kangas, who I don't know.
Kangas.
Yeah. And as a management consultant, to draw up some performance goals. Now, of course, you know, what you're going to be measured against and getting those out on paper really is important. And maybe that what they're trying to do is avoid the situation they got into with Harry Black, where sort of things shifted and then you're really in trouble. So how insistent are they on making these goals real?
I don't know. It's important to note that Harry Kangas is an ardent supporter of the mayor's and had supported him during his 13 campaign and I assume his 17 campaign, although I didn't hear from him during that election. So, it's important to know that, I think. I think you're right, Dan, that it is maybe a little bit to prevent what happened with Harry Black from having happen again. I think the council expects the city manager to view it as one of its one of the city manager's bosses, not just the mayor. And I think at times Harry Black viewed the mayor as his boss, and then that gradually changed as time went on, and they had differences of opinion on things. He looked more to the council, and council, you know, during the political crisis that we had back in March and April, council protected him for 6 full weeks, which was kind of a long time that he hung on there.
I do think it's interesting. I've heard a couple of council members, you know, pitch me that with these performance goals, they're coming from the mayor and the council member. And I've heard that it all shows that we're working together. And to me, that's okay. We're working in together until we're not working together. And I find there are going to be divisions. And, you know, this may be a kumbaya moment where we're going to have, okay, we've got all these performance measures, but then I can almost bet in January there's going to be a decisive vote on something that, you know, we're going to be split again. So it may look good, sound good now, but I don't see that continuing.
You cynical reporters. Let's go on.
Hey, that was one of my traits. I was told I was cynical, negative, and pessimistic.
let's go on to one of the things they actually did vote on, and it wasn't 9-0 or 8-0. It was 5-3, and that's the smoking ordinance. So, Jay, what's actually involved here?
I'm not even comfortable calling it the smoking ordinance per se. We need to refer to it as the tobacco ordinance. Basically, what they've done now, previously, I think I assume under state law, you cannot buy any tobacco product if you're under 18. So what they've done now in the city of Cincinnati has raised that to 21. So anyone 21 and under cannot buy cigarettes, e-cigarettes, cigars, any kind of tobacco product.
Snuff,
chewing tobacco, cigars, anything like that would be – you would have to be 21 years old within the city of Cincinnati to buy those products.
And if you do, and who – this isn't directed at the person who buys them.
It would be just like alcohol. If you sell to someone underage, you're guilty of contributing and selling to a minor. Be the same thing here. The seller would be fined. I think the first offense was $500 and a second offense is $1,250.
Although with alcohol, of course, if you possess it and you're underage, that's
right,
a crime.
Right.
If you possess tobacco and you're under 21 in the city of Cincinnati, that's not a crime still. But, you know, let's be clear here. All you got to do is drive to Norwood or St. Bernard or Newport or Covington, and an 18 to 20-year-old will be able to buy tobacco. This has limited actual, you know, utility for people in terms of preventing them from smoking.
This is not, though, unique to Cincinnati. There, as I understand it, 15 other cities.
There are several
in Ohio.
There are several in Ohio. I don't remember the number, but and it was some big ones like Columbus and I think Akron.
Cleveland, Akron.
Okay. I thought Cleveland and Columbus were in there. And I think the number that one of the speakers on Monday quoted that there were 373 cities and 22 states across the country that have similar legislation. And it's actually, I think it's a Tobacco 21 is the actual name of the movement.
So who was backing this on council? Who was pushing for this, either on council or behind council members?
Well, Tamaya Denard was the chief proponent on council, and you know, she had a lot of support from the members of the Board of Education for the Cincinnati Public Schools, Mike Morawski in particular. So they view this as a way to protect children. They were concerned that people who are 18, 19, and 20 will give cigarettes to 16, 17, maybe, you know, younger kids that they still have connections with, right? And so that's the kind of the impetus behind this thing, is to prevent kids from starting to smoke when they're still in junior high or high school.
And specifically, I think the idea was, because I think Councilmember Young asked for an explanation, how does this keep cigarettes out of the hands of these younger teenagers? And the issue was that you could have 18-year-olds in high school who are still in high school who are able to legally buy cigarettes, give them to their peers, where it's less likely that you're going to have someone 21-year-old. Kids in high school are being less likely to hang out with someone who's 21.
Bigger gap.
Right.
Whatever. So, Chris, since this is – the penalties are focused at businesses.
Right.
What are the implications from a business perspective here?
Well, I think it's – is it a $500 registration fee
each year
if you're going to sell cigarettes? So that's
– and that's a new fee.
That's a new fee, and that's to administer the program.
That's a lot of places that sell
Oh yeah.
Tobacco.
It had a significant – I mean, it'll have a significant you know, impact in some cases of, you know, I'm sure they're not going to want to pay these. I mean, I know they don't want to pay another registration fee at the city. So, you know, that, but yeah, the opposition to this wasn't particularly vocal, I thought.
There were a couple. I think there was somebody from the, and I'm not going to get the term right. It was like a statewide vaping association. And I think there was one other person that spoke Wednesday during public comment that was opposed, but most of the people who spoke were in favor of it.
And there were three council people who voted against it.
Correct. It does not have a veto-proof majority, and it's interesting to note, at least when I checked today on the city's website, the mayor had not yet signed this ordinance. He didn't say from the dais whether he would veto it or anything like that.
I don't think he made any comments at all.
I don't think he did. I know that behind the scenes he was lobbying against it. He wasn't a fan of it. Apparently that centered more on the business implications and the regulations rather than any kind of opposition to banning smoking or banning the sale of cigarettes to 18 to 20-year-olds. But, you know, they passed it over his apparent behind-the-scenes opposition. So, you know, the mayor also can allow something to become law, an ordinance to become law, without actually signing it. So that may be what happens here.
City planners have been working to improve downtown traffic patterns since the first comprehensive plan that was published in 1925. The preliminary report on the latest plan was presented this week to City Council, and it turned every traffic light in the downtown into flashing yellow. To talk about what was in that plan and Council's reaction, we are joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wettery and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join our discussion at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Okay, the traffic report.
I think you'd be better off to phrase it, what was not in the traffic report.
Well, Jay, let's let you get started with this. We'll start maybe on the back end of this, which was council's reaction. I mean, it was very
It was funny because I knew it was a PowerPoint, and I actually got a copy of the PowerPoint about 15 minutes before the presentation started. And I kind of flipped through it, and I thought, this is it. And I even text a council member and I said, have you seen this yet? And he said, well, no, it's supposed to be pretty comprehensive. And then when he came into the chamber and they started going through it, he was the first one to say, this looks rather sloppy and incomplete. That was council member Seelbach. But I think it was much anticipated that you know, this was going to be the document that lays out the solution, especially to get the streetcar to move freer through the central business district. And it talked about that. It listed, I guess, the biggest thing that most council members complained about was, you know, on the slides, it listed all of the various issues and what the problems were, but it really didn't have solutions or how much they were going to cost or how long it would take to implement them to fix the things that were identified as issues or problems in the report.
Well, they all had their unimpressed face on. When I think about the famous meme with Michaela Maroney, the gymnast, they all had that look on their face, like, "Oh, this is not. How come this took so long, and how come it cost us so much money? It was $250,000.
It was at least $250,000.
And so, if you dig through the report, they've been asked to go back. Represent this, I think, December 21st. Is that correct?
Well, that was the first ask, but I think they realized that that's impractical. So I would assume that sometime the first part of January, they'll be back in front of this same committee with another PowerPoint presentation.
So the question I have, though, is the data that is needed there, or is this report just not even have the information, the ideas, and the backup data to make anything of this? I mean, that's two different possibilities.
I mean, they have the data, I think, right?
Yeah,
that's what they told us.
They said that they had thousands of pages of data. It just didn't really translate into the slides that they brought before council members. And part one city official defended them, saying, look, we always intended it to be this way, that we would present you with an initial report, get your feedback, which council was in, gave them plenty of feedback, and they would go back and rework it and come back.
I mean, if we could talk a little bit about what it actually said,
yeah,
things that might be somewhat useful, you know, they did leave open the idea of, first of all, they admit the traffic lights downtown need to be retimed to kind of adjust for, you know, the environment that we have now. Traditionally, traffic has been an east to west thing to get people onto the highway and out of downtown. And there's a lot more pedestrians. We have a lot more bicycle people. We have a lot more, you know, there's just a lot more people, you know, downtown these days. And that may not and is not probably the best way to orient traffic. So that's the first thing. Now, they didn't exactly go light by light and say, this is how we'll retime this or that. So that's one thing. And then, of course, they also said that some of the lights on the streetcar route need to be retimed to account for the volume of public transit, not just the streetcar, but also the bus system, because the bus system uses Walnut Street and it uses Main Street,
we're
just like the streetcar.
North-south there.
Right, north-south, to better flow traffic through there. And they even left open the possibility of allowing the lights to change when the streetcar or buses approach it, or to extend a green light longer so that the streetcar and buses can get through the intersection without having to stop, you know, every block, basically.
Well, you know, one of the things that struck me when I took a look at it is that very early in the report, it said that it supported fixed time
right
traffic lights. Other cities have gone to lights that can be manipulated at different times based on traffic and automating a lot of that using IoT, Internet of Things, and all sorts of things. And this report right from the beginning said, fixed time, we're going to stick with what we got, but we may lengthen it a little bit.
And with some of the exceptions I just said, I mean, but yeah, you're right. I mean, that was notable. And I don't know what the expectation was on that. I kind of didn't expect them to change the fixed time situation that much. But I did think that they would be forced to retime everything, because it's just not optimal for people who are downtown and intend to stay there and do things.
Well, what about the new bus lane, bus only lane that, you know, a couple months ago there was a lot of, you know, it was going to be put in, and now there's been reporting that nobody's paying attention to it. And did that come up?
People are parking it. It did come up, and you know, we had the normal shtick from the administration, which is, oh, we're working on it. We're working really hard on it. And,
they talked about how many tickets they had written. And it's just like anything else. When there are enforcement officers around, people don't park in it. But when people don't see the enforcement officers, they're parking it. I mean, and every day on either Facebook or Twitter, there's a picture of the, you know, the experimental bus lane on Main Street. Here's another car, 4:30, here's a car sitting in the dedicated bus lane.
Yeah, I don't think it's marked very well. I think that's part of the problem.
Well, they talked about that because I think there was some thought that they needed to put like bus lane on the pavement. And they said the reason they didn't do that is because it's a pilot project. They want to make sure that if it's pilot, they didn't want to go to the expense of marking the lane on the pavement, which I think would make a difference, because it's easier to tell that if you're driving over top of bus lane all the time as opposed to have to look up on the side of the street to see a sign.
Every other city I've seen with a bus lane has it painted on the street. And Greg Landsman, the council member, said to the administration, look, if you actually want to have a pilot program that has legitimate results, you're probably going to have to paint the street. And there was no conclusion to that discussion, but we'll see if the administration listens to that view.
I want to get on to very quickly, because we don't have much time left, but question of the county budget. Did we finally get a settlement over on the county budget,
Chris? We did, and there was a lot of cuts to it. They raised the property transfer tax. Not quite a doomsday budget, but it was there were deep cuts. Like a lot of times at the city, we'll see, you know, the doomsday budget trotted out in May or June, and then gradually everything gets kind of put back. That didn't happen with the county. They ended up cutting quite a bit. They cut business groups, which I've not seen happen yet. They cut some of the law enforcement spending. They did put back all the money, pretty much all the money for the heroin task forces that they have. But they're in a real pickle. They remain in a pickle. They're gonna have a big deficit next year.
Yeah, it's not going to get any better next year.
It's not getting any better. So, you know, I would expect that sales tax increase that was discussed earlier this year to come back on the table. First, though, the Cincinnati Business Committee and Regional Business Committee are going to do their scrub of the county's finances to try to find efficiencies. And I think the commissioners are going to hear about that first before they take any action on taxes.
And very quickly, Jay, what about over at the city? When will things develop?
Our budget fund is just starting. The first thing council has to do in the new year is set the property tax rate for calendar year 2020,
yep.
which affects sort of the next fiscal year budget, which would be the
– Starts
in
July.
It starts in July, but this would be the portion from January to July of 2020. There are two proposals. We already know the projected deficit is either $16 million or $18 million. The lower amount depends on council collecting the full 6.1 mils that they're allowed to under the city charter. The $18 million deficit, council continues its policy to roll that back so that they never collect more than $29 million. And my assumption is that we'll be doing that same thing again.
So the point is they have the power to balance this budget, but they haven't wanted to do it politically.
I don't know
for
that
decades.
It wouldn't balance it, but it would, I think.
Come close.
I don't know. I think it was like
It would add a couple more million dollars.
It's been continuous since the year 2000. And I think one time the officials had estimated that it cost the city like $50 to $60 million in revenue.
It's got to be closer to 80 now, I would think. But yeah, it's they've left a lot of money on the table from that property tax.
Well, I want to thank Chris and Jay for being here and bringing so much happy news from City Hall and County Courthouse. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Lame duck sessions of legislatures can either be sleepy affairs or a wild rush to get things done. Even though Ohio Republicans will retain solid control of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, as the clock ticks down, the legislature is frantically at work, even on bills they know that Governor John Kasich will veto. To discuss what's happening in Columbus, we are joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmer, Ohio Public Radio reporter Andy Chow, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Welcome, everyone, to Cincinnati Edition.
Hey.
Well,
thanks for having us.
It just seems to me that there's no place to start better than the passage of Senate Bill 296, which Governor Kasich has described as that grubby pay bill. So, Jesse, can you tell us what happened here? What's in this bill and why there's so many legislators who support it and the governor who opposes it?
Sure. So basically, the bill started as a proposal to increase benefits for the widows and children of fallen police officers and firefighters killed in the line of duty. So something that a lot of people were on board with. But what was added to it at the last minute were pay raises for state lawmakers, state executive elected officials like the governor, like all the folks we just picked. And county officials and township officials. And so what you have is this kind of combination bill of pay raises, which is something that John Kasich has said, you know, this isn't something he supports, especially in this lame duck session where people were, you know, just elected. Some of these people are leaving. You know, this isn't the right time to do it if there is a right time to do it. Added to this bill that a lot of people like this benefits for kind of the widows and orphans. So it's going to be interesting what John Kasich does on this. He's not a fan. The state lawmakers have said that they're willing to come back. The Senate just set a date for the 27th to potentially override John Kasich's veto on this.
So, Andy, this passed last night, right?
Well, it depends on what last night means, because in the Senate it passed at past midnight. So, it technically passed earlier today.
This morning,
but yeah, it passed. And to add to what Jesse was saying, this is the kind of thing where you know, lawmakers attach it to something like the death benefits for families of first responders. And in a way, it gives them political cover in the future. So when they say if they're ever tagged for voting for a pay raise for themselves, they could say, well, no, I voted for this bill that gives benefits to the families of people who were killed in the line of duty. And then it just so happened that it attached to it was a pay raise that gave me an 11% raise over the course of 3 years. Yeah. So then, you know, this is how politics is played. And this is just something that, like you said, there's this wild rush at the end of the clock as time is ticking down, where legislators are trying to get things passed, and this is something that we usually see in a lame duck.
Now, to be fair on this, there have been no pay raises for these people, legislators, administrators, statewide administration people, county officials, township officials, since 2008. So there is a long gap here,
so
right?
The state folks, it's been since 2008. The county folks got a bit of a raise in 2015, just to clarify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, all that's true. You know, I mean, it's absolutely true. And I'm not arguing, you know, that they don't deserve a pay raise. But to tell you the truth, this is the kind of thing that makes people hate politics. I mean, it really does. Because, you know, you play this Christmas tree, let's hang everything on the tree and pass it in one big thing. And Andy, you know, made a good point about, you know, they can go back and say, oh, no, I was voting for
widows and orphans.
Widows and orphans, yeah. of first responders, whom everyone cares about. Everyone cares about. They don't care about, the bank accounts of state legislators or county commissioners or township trustees who depend upon the legislature for setting their pay. I just don't think people are going to buy that argument again. I don't think the people 2 years from now when a whole bunch of these people, the whole House and the Senate are up for reelection, that people are going to buy that argument, and it's going to come back and bite them.
So this is going to be a political issue in your mind?
Sure it is.
An election issue. Jesse, it sounded like you were about to say something there.
Oh, I was going to – this is Andy. I was going to say that this is from the top down too. So you got to also remember that legislators who are about to go into statewide office, so you have Frank LaRose, mm-hmm. Robert Sprague, Keith Faber, they all abstained. None of them voted for this bill because, I mean – They'd be voting for a pretty big raise for themselves because they're about to take office that pays more anyway.
So what do people make now? If you're in the House of what salary are you making?
Right now, they make about $60,400. If you're just a plain old House member, a plain member in the House or Senate, you're making about $60,000 and a couple hundred more. Mm. And that's if you don't have a leadership position. That's if you're not a committee chair or anything. And this would go up to about, I think, $65,000 a year in 3 years, something like that. I'm sorry, I'm not quite getting it. But it's an 11% raise over the course of 3 years. So some would say that this is a modest increase. Actually, Bill Seitz, the Cincinnati area representative who proposed this and attached it to the bill, he wanted to call it the it's not a COLA, meaning it's not a cost of living adjustment raise, because it doesn't really, I don't think it meets that threshold. And he used to call it a diet COLA, and he's like, it's not even that anymore, so he's calling it the Coke Zero raise.
Well, that's very clever, Bill, but you know, the fact is, They could do this in a standalone up or down vote, period. You know, give yourself a raise. I don't care. I mean, you know, 60,000 up to 65,000, that's probably fair, given the fact of how much travel they have to do back and forth between their districts in Columbus. Some of them, you know, driving for hours and hours to get to the state house, and how much it costs to actually be a state representative or a state senator. I don't mind that. I just – this idea of just – of glomming on to the widows and children of the first responders is just abhorrent to me.
Well, what about – what are the options here? Can Kasich – if Kasich vetoes this, are there enough votes to override his veto? And is there time to override his veto?
So if Kasich vetoes this, once it hits his desk, he has 10 days, Sunday's not included, to make a decision to either sign it, veto it, or let it take effect without his signature. He has been pretty vocal that he doesn't like pay raises and would, I think if it was just a standalone pay raise bill, I would say 100% he was going to veto it. I'm not sure if the fact that it's added to this other bill gives him pause at all, or if he still just doesn't like the method, he's going to veto it anyway. Lawmakers would have to come back after Christmas to override a veto. Both Republicans and Democrats voted for this bill. In the Senate, only 5 people voted against the changes. So I think they could certainly pass this, override the veto.
And, you know, yesterday, Governor John Kasich said, "Do I look like somebody who would sign a bill to give lawmakers pay raises?" And I guess I just now realized the way he said it, he doesn't have to sign it in order for it to become law, because he could just not.
Yeah. He could just let it go.
Literally sign it. Yeah.
Howard, you this whole you're setting up just before sort of the political implications of this for 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. You wrote a blog this week on the WVXU website about whether Ohio was blue, was red, yeah, was purple. Is it purple? Is it a swing state? Or has it become really solidly red? Or is it pink? I know it's not just about this issue, but what's your argument?
Well, my only argument is that I think that the one thing the Democrats have going for them after a really bad election, except for Hamlin County and a few other victories, is the fact that they are getting much better at recruiting candidates for these state legislative seats. You know, they have more people of more substance and of more experience in running for public office and of understanding public policy issues. I think that some of those races are going to start becoming – and their ability to raise money. Some of these races are going to be much more competitive. Now, you know, what do they pick up, a net of 5 in the House? Am I correct?
Yeah.
They did this last term.
Right. Okay, so that's a start, you know, and they hope to build on that in the subsequent elections. I think it's possible. I'm not saying it will happen. I'm not saying it won't happen. But I think they are getting better at this, and they're starting to understand how to deal with a legislative district map which is totally drawn for Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to and Jesse, let's start with you. There are a number of anti-abortion bills that are working their way through the legislature, and you know, how they play against each other is also another set of questions. Can you explain what the legislature is doing and where they stand on these pieces of legislation?
Certainly. So basically, Ohio lawmakers are sending John Kasich 2 different bills related to access to abortion. The first one that's probably gotten the most attention is called the heartbeat bill. Essentially, it would ban abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. They made a bit of a tweak saying that you didn't need to do an internal or transvaginal ultrasound, that you could do an external one. So that might bump that back to between a ban as soon as like 8 to 10 weeks. And so that's going to John Kasich. He has previously said that he would veto that bill. There was some concern about the constitutionality of it being struck down in other areas. He vetoed a very similar bill in 2016 in the prior lame duck, saying that, you know, it'd just be very costly for Ohio to defend this case. So that's the heartbeat bill. The second bill that they're sending him is a ban on a particular procedure used in abortion called dilation and evacuation. It's common in the second trimester, and so would eliminate the most common procedure used in second trimester abortions, which would be as early as 12 weeks. This has support from groups like Ohio Right to Life. John Kasich has signed a number of Ohio Right to Life bills in the past, so I think if he's signing either of these, it's going to be that one. But he hasn't been very vocal about that particular bill.
Andy, what Jesse just pointed out there was that a similar bill passed in the last lame duck. Now we're into another lame duck, and this this, the heartbeat bill is sort of back here again. Why didn't it get picked up when the new legislature came in and pushed through? Why does it keep waiting till the lame duck session?
That's a great question, Dan, because that's what we were trying to point out 2 years ago. To put yourself in the situation where we were 2 years ago, the legislature passed the heartbeat bill. They sent it to the governor. He vetoed it. And then they had a few weeks to come back to override it. And they ultimately decided, hey, listen, we have the votes to override it, but let's just wait and pass it again next year and push it through next year when we have more time. And of course, I mean, it's just like a high school student who procrastinates on a big paper, right? When you get more time, then the more time you kind of just push it down the road. And that's just sort of what happened here, where they had a chance to pass it earlier and they didn't. And you tend to see these controversial pieces of legislation move later in session. I don't know if it's because they carry more of a bargaining chip as far as getting other things approved as well. So it's hard to read exactly why leadership would do it a different way. You have to also remember that we had sort of a weird thing happen this year where we didn't have a speaker for more than 50 days. So that might have messed up the agenda as well.
Well, I was just wondering, though, is... putting it off to the lame duck session, is this a way of protecting the discussion during the campaign so that you don't have to debate this as openly during the campaign?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, rather than, you know, make this a centerpiece of a statewide campaign, I don't think anybody really wants to do that, or not most legislators. And I think this time they think they can override it.
I do wonder about that, though, because a lot of the legislators who ran for re-election this year had already put their name one side or the other on that vote in the last session.
Yeah.
So a lot of people did draw the line in the sand, and it was a big issue in the gubernatorial race. Both Cordray and DeWine were asked about heartbeat bill. Of course, Cordray said he would veto the heartbeat bill, but Mike DeWine said that he would sign it. So it was something that did come up a few times in the campaign season.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raised.
I think there is some question whether they're going to have the votes to override this bill. The votes in the House and the Senate were shy of the 3/5 majority that they would need to override a veto. So it'll be interesting. You're not going to get many Democrats signing on to this one compared to like the pay raise benefit bill that you would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the point here is, and Andy just sort of brought this up, Mike DeWine said that he would sign this. Mike DeWine's coming into office in January. If this doesn't work, if they don't override the veto, could they bring it right back up in the next session and get it passed, knowing they've got a governor who will sign it?
I think they can. Like Howard pointed out, the Republicans are losing a few seats, but I think the Republicans still have plenty of votes to pass something like this. I think there's a couple of different factors going in. For one, I think that the Republicans see the ball on the 1 yard line, so they see why not just push it through now instead of wait until the sessions and start all this committee process over again. That might play into why they might want to just override a veto now. But then also, you never know. I mean, the more pessimistic side of me would say maybe they want to sort of like hit Kasich a little bit. There's been a little tension between the Republicans and the governor's administration. So you never know if maybe they want to serve up Kasich some little, you know, negativity.
And clearly, I mean, if this is over, this is a override of a veto, this thing's going to court. And it's going to stay in court for a long time, and it's going to move up the ladder, possibly to the U.S. Supreme Court, where obviously there have been changes in the last few years. And they look at it, the Right to Life movement looks at it and says, maybe there is a possibility that we could do something like this. But even many of them look at this heartbeat bill with its no exceptions for rape or incest and say, well, this goes a little too far. This probably won't stand up to legal scrutiny. And that's going to be a big question.
But as I see, as I've read about this, some supporters of the heartbeat bill say this is designed to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
They're perfectly happy to have it tied up in court and then go to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
So
I would say on both of these proposals, the proponents are expecting and would be happy about a legal challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for that very reason. Certainly a less weighty thing, but issue is some spending bill, $15 million for the Columbus crew in Columbus. Is the state legislature thinking of itself as just building up its hometown there in Columbus?
Well, if you look at that, I mean, that was definitely the Christmas tree bill of this year. That was where a bunch of different appropriations were attached. If you look at the bigger ticket items, they were all in Columbus. So you have $15 million for the new Columbus Crew Stadium. You have $20 million for reconstructing the State House garage, and then another $2 million for the governor's residence, which has not been lived in for the past 8 years. I guess the case can be made that there's definitely a lot of money flowing to Central Ohio.
Yeah, that's always been the case. I mean, no matter who the governor is, where he comes from, and this governor comes from Central Ohio, that's where the money's going to flow. Now, this new governor, Mike DeWine, is really more associated with Southwest Ohio, Cincinnati, Dayton, that area. And it'll be interesting to see if the priorities of the administration and the legislature change over
on the capital budget.
On the capital budget.
Yeah. Jesse, one of the things I think we ought to point out about this is that the mayor of Cincinnati and the head of FC Cincinnati are totally in support of money for the Columbus crew, right?
So on the floor, Bill Seitz, who we mentioned earlier, state representative from the Green Township area, read an email from John Cranley saying, it's great, let's keep this rivalry in Ohio, and, FC Cincinnati is going to beat the crew, in this new rivalry, et cetera. So I think a lot of people, myself included, looked at the numbers. FC Cincinnati had requested $10 million initially, ultimately got $4 million for infrastructure related to its stadium. Obviously that was in a different time of the year that we were looking at that in the capital budget versus the end of the year, this Christmas tree bill. But it does look like a bit of a disparity. Other factors involved are the Columbus Crew Stadium. They're renovating their old stadium to be more of a public sports park, and the new stadium has some residences, some earmarked for lower income. So I think they're pitching it as this greater revitalization of Columbus, but it's interesting just the difference in numbers.
Well, and there's also a strategy here.
Go ahead, Andy.
There's also a strategy here where of course, if you've been following the saga, the owner wanted to move the crew to Austin, and there's this tactic of, well, if you play in a stadium that gets public money, then you cannot relocate that team. This is the Art Modell law, based on Art Modell taking the Browns out of Cleveland.
Yeah.
So the state wanted to make sure that they threw some money in the pot to make sure that they cleared the Art Modell threshold in case this ever came up again.
Okay, I want to move on to a couple of quick things here at the end. Where do we stand, Andy, where do we stand with the medical marijuana program? We're almost at the end of the year.
Oh, man.
Well, I can't resist.
No, you're right. You're right. It's a great question. It's hard to say. I mean, technically, the program is underway. It's happening. It's just a matter of getting certain licenses in place. It's a matter of the product to be grown and cultivated, and then the dispensaries to sell it. So I forget where we left off, but I'm pretty sure dispensaries are starting to get their licenses right now. I think we're in that phase of the product is being grown, and the dispensaries are either getting their licenses or about to get their licenses. So I don't think we're going to see anything change by the end of the year. Maybe we're going to see some bigger steps taken in January, maybe February.
Now, people who want to make use of this, they have to find a doctor who will prescribe, or if not prescribe, recommend, whatever the technical terms are.
Yeah, they give them a certificate or something.
Certificate, so.
Yeah, and doctors are able to give out that certificate now. Their doctors can become licensed certificate givers at this point.
And that will not be hard to do.
Was a concern initially that there weren't going to be enough doctors, but that really hasn't been the case.
So. Yeah.
And actually, you can go to Cincinnati.com and we have a list of, you know, the doctors that have signed up to recommend medical marijuana. But you need to go to the doctor. The doctor puts you on the list and then you would get like your card or what have you through that process.
Okay. One final thing. We've mentioned him multiple times here this afternoon. Mike DeWine is moving towards becoming the next governor. What's happening there in terms of putting together the administration? Jesse?
Well, right now he's setting up who's going to be in what roles, and has a lot of the people that he has picked so far have come from the Attorney General's office or have been with him throughout his long political career. So that makes a lot of sense. I have been impressed. There's been a lot of women and people of color that he's picked for some of these high positions, which I think is important. And then also the part of the pay raise bill was setting up this new department for the Lieutenant Governor, John Husted, and they're working on this like Innovate Ohio system. So I think that's a lot of looking at technology. I don't know all of the details at this juncture.
Yeah, economic development using modernized technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are a few of the things that are working on there. It's a lot of just picking all the people that need to be in these roles to run state government.
Howard, I don't know if you've been following this, but it strikes me as I've seen the announcements coming out, just as Jesse was saying, that these are people who Mike DeWine is very familiar with so far.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
He's putting his people.
He's going to put his stamp on this very definitely. No question about it. And it's really interesting because Houston's going to have a pretty big role to play.
Trying to make the lieutenant governor role more significant than has been in the past. So through this Innovation Center. And John Husted, of course, was interested in running for governor.
Yes.
And, you know, is clearly somebody who
and has not lost interest in that.
Has not lost interest in that, trying to create a part of the resume for the future on that. So, well, I want to thank everybody for being here today. The clearly, we've had a lot over this past year happening in Columbus, and thank you for keeping us updated, bringing us the news, and really have appreciated all of the work over the past few months since I've been in this chair. So thank you very much, Jesse, Andy, and Howard.
Of course.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WPXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.